This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in St. Paul. Home is where the heart is, but it's much more than that. It's where our lives take root, where our families grow and build a sense of belonging in a community. Those comforts of home can be taken for granted until they're not there anymore. This month marks the 14th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina making landfall. After that storm, many families lost their homes, which were either wiped out by the hurricane or demolished by the city of New Orleans later on. The latter is what happened to Sarah Broom's family home. It was a shotgun yellow house in New Orleans East. This loss and the following displacement for her family led Broom to question the mythologized image of New Orleans and where exactly she and her family fit in. What does it mean to be from a place? Broom is a writer and a New Orleans native. Her new memoir is called The Yellow House, where she delves into the loss of her family home and its lingering effects on her family's lives. And she joins us now from New Orleans to discuss it. Sarah, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Broom, let's start with the book, The Yellow House. How did the book come about?
Well, I wanted to think about the ways in which, in New Orleans in particular, certain stories are privileged over others and sort of told over and over again. And I had been obsessed with this yellow house that I'd grown up in that my mother bought in 1961 when she was 19 years old with her savings. And, you know, I wanted to think about what story that house would tell, you know, me and my 11 siblings. I'm the baby of 12 children, grew up in that house. And I wanted to think about the house as a kind of metaphor for how to talk about ultimately what it means to be from New Orleans and also what it means to be American.
Would it be hyperbole to describe the book as kind of a biography of a house?
No, I love that. I think it is the autobiography of a house. And, you know, how this house was a historical monument for my family, right? Whether or not the city agreed. And I really wanted to think about what it means when someone says that a house is not historical in nature, because I think all of us are deeply connected to place and that houses have stories and that they are, in fact, meaningful.
Now, I've been to New Orleans a couple of times, but I think most people who have not been to the part that's known as New Orleans East. Could you just describe for folks where New Orleans East is, other than East, in relationship to New Orleans? It's a ways out from the way you described it in the book.
Sure. It's actually about 12 minutes from the French Quarter driving, and it's the east is actually bifurcated from the rest of the city by the Industrial Canal, which is a navigation channel connecting Lake Pontchartrain and the Mississippi River. And the east is actually quite vast, with lots of different neighborhoods in it. It isn't the New Orleans that most people imagine when they think of the city, right? There aren't second lines rolling through the streets, and the architecture is a bit different. It's flatter, the landscape, doesn't quite have all the signs and signifiers that most people think of. But it's a real community and a real neighborhood that people love and feel that they belong to.
What's it like demographically?
So right now, there are, I think, a little more than 78,000 New Orleanians in the East. And in terms of space, it's about a third of the city writ large. It's an interesting and diverse place, but I think it's a place that people don't write about and don't often talk about when they talk about what it means to be from New Orleans.
Is it high income, low income?
I think it's a bit of a mix. A lot of the people who work in to support the tourism industry live in New Orleans East. If you were to look at a map of where a lot of the hotel and restaurant workers live, many of them live in the East and commute to the city and then back to the French Quarter and then back.
You anchor the book in the beginning with a long focus on your mother. You said she bought this house, which you call the Yellow House, when she was 19 years old. Talk about what this house meant to her.
Well, my mother was someone who always cared so much about making a home for her family. She comes from women for whom this was also important. My grandmother was someone who loved to make a house, right, and to create a warmth and a place for her family. So it was a really big deal for my mother to see this house and buy it when she was only 19. And she built a world inside of this house with her family. And she was a gardener, and she, you know, was a seamstress. So she made the curtains and changed them out with the seasons. You know, the house was for her a major point of pride. And also an investment, right? And the thing that most of us who are buying houses count on is that over time, your investment will pay off for you. And the story of this house, of course, is that she was building the ground up from the moment she moved in. You know, subsidence was already happening.
And the tragedy of it in many ways is that, you know, research shows that for many African-American families, their primary source of wealth is the equity in their home, as opposed to for white families who are more likely to have wealth in investments that don't depend on place and weather to survive. So I can only imagine what it did to the family when not only the home was destroyed, but they kind of had to migrate. They had to scatter and find other places to be.
Sure. And I, that question of where people have the resources to build and to live, and especially Black people and people of color in the city, we know that disproportionately people can afford to live in the places that are actually most vulnerable and most fragile. And so often I'm really interested in exploring the question of place and to not only talk about it. I think often when it comes to the stories of Black people in New Orleans in particular, it's sort of shrouded in these big ideas, right? But then also people have lives. And, you know, Toni Morrison called life a gallant event. And I wanted to also just tell a particular story about a family and what their actual daily life was like, and to also talk about the joys of that life so that their lives could exceed the moments of disaster, right?
Bill in Inverness, Florida, is a member of the 1A Text Club. And Bill writes, having lost two homes in the last 4 years, I feel qualified to respond. The first was a big farm of 17 years when my dad died to predatory siblings. The second, a modest RV trailer of 2 years to Hurricane Irma. Both times I left with one van full of stuff. Back up your pictures and videos to the cloud to multiple accounts. Get a big safety deposit box at your bank and use it. You can lose your home. It's going to the associated funerals. That's rough. Another member of the 1A Text Club wrote, yes, I lost my home in a divorce. Even 10 years later, the loss feels devastating to me on a personal level as well as a financial asset. My home was in a wonderful community that I'd lived in for 30 years. I miss it still. I purchased my beautiful little lake home as a single mother in the mid-90s and was so proud of myself for being able to do that. So I was absolutely gutted when I lost it. Sarah Broom, were you living in the Yellow House when Katrina hit?
So I wasn't. I live in Harlem, and at the time was living in Harlem and working for O Magazine in New York as a writer. I had been home just a few days before the storm hit, but was back in New York when my family was scattering. And one of the things I'm really interested in is, you know, I wondered how I could tell the story of what it means to not have been home when the storm came, to have not been with my family. I think there is also, for many of us who experience that, a trauma and something to be worked through and processed.
Where did they scatter to when Katrina came?
To so many places. So to Texas and to Alabama and to California and to Mississippi and to Atlanta. I think there were six or seven cities that people were were displaced to. And for many of my siblings, you know, they, some of them haven't yet returned, and many of them have only recently returned. And, you know, so there's always a question of who can afford to return, and also how New Orleans has changed coming back after the storm, the way that, you know, rents are higher. And in many ways, it's harder to live in the city now.
I definitely want to talk about where New Orleans is today in a little bit, but I'd like you to read a passage from the book. I believe it's the passage on pages 3 and 4, right at the front of the book. Before you read it, can you just set up what this passage describes?
Sure. So this is from a section called Map, which is the opening of the book. And it's a kind of verbal map I wrote to orient the reader in the space and in the world that I know best.
All right. Here's Sarah Broom with that excerpt from The Yellow House.
From high up, 15,000 feet above, where the aerial photographs are taken, 4121 Wilson Avenue, the address I know best, is a minuscule point, a scab of green. In satellite images shot from higher still, my former street dissolves into the toe of Louisiana's boot. From this vantage point, our address, now mite size, would appear to sit in the Gulf of Mexico. Distance lends perspective, but it can also shade, misinterpret. From these great heights, my brother Carl would not be seen. Carl, who is also my brother Rabbit, sits his days and nights away at 4121 Wilson Avenue at least 5 times a week after working his maintenance job at NASA, or when he is not fishing or near to the water where he loves to be. 4,015 days past the water, beyond all news cycles known to man, still sits a skinny man in shorts, white socks pulled up to his kneecaps, one gold picture frame around his front tooth. Sometimes you can find Carl alone on our lot, poised on an ice chest, searching the view, as if for a sign, as if for a wonder, or else seated at a pecan-colored dining table with intricately carved legs, holding court. The table where Carl sometimes sits is on the spot where our living room used to be, but where instead of floor, there is green grass trying to grow. See Carl gesturing with the long arm if he feels like it, wearing dark shades even if it is night. See Rabbit with his legs crossed at the ankle, a long-legged man, knotted up. I can see him there now in my mind's eye, silent and holding a beer, babysitting ruins. But that is not his language or sentiment. He would never betray the yellow house like that. Carl often finds company on Wilson Avenue where he keeps watch. Friends will arrive and pop their trunks, revealing coolers containing spirits on ice. Help yourself, baby, they will say. If someone has to pee, they do it in what used to be our den, or they use the bright blue porta potty sitting at the back of the yard where the shed once was. Now, this plastic vertical bathroom is the only structure on the lot. Written on its front in white block letters on black background, City of New Orleans.
An excerpt from The Opening of The Yellow House by Sarah Broom. I take away from that, Sarah, that even though the city doesn't really recognize this house as existing on the map anymore, you do, and the people to whom the house mattered still do, and it's still a place where life goes on. I mean, the section is called Map, and a large part of your book is about sort of remapping New Orleans East and where you lived so it doesn't just kind of disappear off of people's memories as well as off of people's maps. Is that it?
Sure. There is, I believe, a revolutionary quality to simply telling the story of the people who I know best, who live in the area I know, which is New Orleans East. And I thought of myself in this book as a kind of cartographer, revising and expanding a map of New Orleans so that it contained the world where I grew up, you know. And I have a complicated relationship to maps because I know the ways that maps can exclude certain communities. I know the historical way that Native Americans were essentially written off of a map that belonged to them in certain ways. And so I wanted to think about how we position ourselves in a city and to just tell in a really detailed way the story of these lives so that they could last and stand the test of time.
I want to know more about what your reckoning has been with all this as we continue our conversation, but I just want to make sure we're clear for the purposes of going forward. After Katrina, after, you know, the levees broke, the city of New Orleans came through, bulldozed the house, and then, like, took it off its records? Or I want to make sure I understand what we're talking about when we say that the house is no longer mapped. Is there no record of it anymore? Or, like, what does that mean?
Sure. So the house was damaged quite badly in 2005 after Katrina. And in 2006, the house was demolished by the city without my mother or any of us knowing exactly when it was going to happen. So one day my brother Carl, who I just read about, showed up and the house was simply gone. And so we were left to contend with this enormous loss. You know, many years later, I went to the city and asked them questions about the house being demolished. And they gave me a file that had the demolition records and also had a letter that was, in fact, sent to the mailbox in front of the soon-to-be-demolished house.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment with Native New Orleanian Sarah Broom. Her new book, her new memoir, is called The Yellow House. Glad to get to some of your questions and thoughts and reactions to the book. Tom in Washington tweeted, "Wonderful, beautiful imagery from The Yellow House. Thank you for reading." Also want to get to some of your questions about the nature of New Orleans. And Sarah, I'd like to get a better sense of your reckoning with all of this and what kind of has driven you to have the conception of your home in your head and your heart that you have now. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Bonnie, a Home Instead caregiver, works to enhance the lives of her aging clients and their families. Here, she shares her golden rule for care.
I would want her to be treated the way I'd want to be treated. I come in and take care of her and do all of her personal care needs that she needs done and make sure she stays comfortable in her own home. We have a good time. We're best friends.
To learn more about Home Instead Senior Care's in-home care options, go to homeinstead.com.
It might be hard to pin down what makes a friendship really work.
I feel like we're like the Michael Jordan of friendships. Like, you can't ask Jordan. You can't ask Jordan how he does what he does. He's a freak of nature.
But clearly, some people know how to do it. Check out Life Kit's new guide from NPR on navigating the highs and lows of friendship, or subscribe to Life Kit All Guides for all of our episodes all in one place.
Back now to our conversation with author Sarah Broom. Her new memoir is called The Yellow House. Let me get to a few of your comments. Estrel Keniak in Raleigh, North Carolina, tweeted, "As a real estate broker, I would never recommend getting emotionally attached to a house. It is better to think of a house as a financial tool to help you grow to the next one." Sarah, what about that, getting emotionally attached to a house?
Well, that's an impossibility for someone like me. I think many of us are emotionally tied to place. That feels to me like a human quality. And I think houses are economic investments, obviously, on a literal level. But there's so much more than that. And I think that's a very global thing for most people.
I think also the nature of home ownership, just for Black folks in general, is fraught with so many other elements, whether it was the period in time where we weren't allowed to have property, but we were only able to be property, to the various ways in which we were redlined and restricted from living in certain parts of certain cities by the federal government, to just not being able to have the same civic and social services as people in non-Black parts of town. I think for African Americans especially, and correct me if I'm wrong, in a multicultural city like New Orleans, where you live and how you live just means too much for it to merely be an investment. Am I wrong?
That's absolutely right. And I am really interested also in how, for instance, public policy and city planning sometimes fails certain communities of color, right? And we see these things happening. I grew up on a street that had zoning problems. There were, tow companies setting up shop on the street. So of course that affects the value of my mother's investment, right? So all of these things are more than concepts or ideas when you are a Black American person thinking about your investment and what that means, especially when so many of the systemic injustices are literally baked into the soil.
I do want to acknowledge, though, several of you have written into us saying that your connection to home as an emotional tie is not the same. It's not that strong. Les tweeted, "I've lived in 11 different houses in my life and recently sold my mother's home upon her demise. No biggie. They're just buildings. I am more than where I live, but I understand people's connection and investment in place. I like my current house. It's just not me." Another listener emailed, "Having had to move for my spouse's job every 3 to 5 years for the past 30 years to 4 states, Germany, and the District of Columbia, I've never had the luxury of a home place. I don't understand that as being a right to which anyone should feel entitled, especially when job availability or the landscape, like coastal loss, etc., makes that an unrealistic expectation." Sarah, can you talk about your reckoning with leaving New Orleans and not having that home to come back to? You talk about your life as before the water, meaning Katrina and the breaking of the levees, and after the water, capital W. And you spent time in Burundi, now you're in New York. What was that process like, just dealing with it emotionally?
Well, I think for my family, we were suddenly, after Katrina, scattered in a way that we hadn't been before. So it was harder for all of us to get together in one room, and that in certain ways changed the family dynamic. I think for my own self, there's a thing I was contending with almost from the moment I left the house in the early mid to late 90s for college, was what it felt like to keep coming back home and realizing, for instance, that I was, to my great disappointment, an exception. Often when I'd come back to New Orleans and to my family, I had many of my childhood friends had died. Many of them were in jail. That the life I was living, or the opportunities I had, were in fact not the opportunities that many of the people I loved, who I grew up with, had had. And so part of my writing this book was to contend with, you know, why is that? And what are the systems and the structures in place that make that so? I'm not interested in being an exception.
For your research on whose stories are getting told in New Orleans, you lived for a year in the French Quarter, which is pretty much the most mythologized part of the city. I'm sure that it was at times fun, at times definitely loud. But what did you learn from living in the French Quarter for a year that you didn't know from having been a native of New Orleans in a different part of town?
Well, it was so interesting to live right there at the corner of Royal and St. Peter, because so many of the city's stories about itself are told from the French Quarter. And every single day I would see the intersection of New Orleanians who were coming in to sort of work there, right? Because we know 68% of Black New Orleanians, for instance, work in the hotel industry, and 13% of Hispanics do. And so I would see New Orleanians coming in, as I did as a teenager, and then returning home to elsewhere. But then also the sort of performative nature of the French Quarter, and the ways in which tourists would pay almost anything to sort of be part of it. And I understood how that was so compelling, right? But what was interesting for me is that I was leaving the quarter every single day and driving driving to my siblings. My brother Carl was in New Orleans East. My brother Michael was in New Orleans East. And seeing the massive gap between the way life was lived in this rented apartment in the French Quarter and, you know, how my brother was living, it was such a stark contrast and taught me a lot about where the city's investments are, really.
I should note, by the way, for those of you who are kind of familiar with New Orleans, Royal and St. Peter, I'm just looking at it on the map, is like the middle of the French Quarter. It's a half block from Preservation Hall. It's about one block from Jackson Square, block and a half from Café du Monde. It sits right on the water, on the Mississippi River. So this is like the epicenter of the French Quarter, where, you know, where all the tourists like to hang out. To that point, though, Eric emailed, "Just last week, I booked a trip for my partner and I to New Orleans in March. When we travel, we like to understand the sense of place of our destination in addition to the usual tourist checklist. What should a first-time visitor to New Orleans understand about your city that will give them a deeper context beyond the veneer of tourism?" Sarah?
Ooh, that's such a good question. I think part of what I try to tell friends of mine who come is always to just go beyond, drive beyond, get an Uber someplace with the local person and hear their stories and just try to push the frame and expand the frame and to also just notice, for instance, the ways in which you can be on a certain block and there be great wealth and then turn the corner and there's immense poverty. And in New Orleans, these things live so close to each other. A lot of it, I think, is about noticing and seeing and not being afraid to sort of interrogate the given story of the city.
I want to talk a little bit more about that story. I do want to acknowledge many of you are sending us your stories of what has happened to you in terms of home displacement. Here is a voicemail from Kirsty, who left a note in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Kirsty. I live in Norfolk, Virginia. My maternal grandmother and maternal great-grandmother's properties are currently for sale in Jamestown, Rhode Island. They are $500,000 and $600,000, respectively. I purchased a home 2 years ago at the top of my budget for $275,000. And that's here in Norfolk, Virginia. My family could not reconsider going back to Jamestown, Rhode Island, just for the fact that it's well outside of our budget.
Yeah, Kirsty, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. Sarah, one of the other aspects of New Orleans East has to do with its history with NASA work and the space race. What's that story?
So, you know, one of the big things about New Orleans East is that NASA is there, and New Orleans East has played a huge role in you know, the space age and the Apollo missions and the Saturn missions and the rocket boosters, which are the kind of thrust of these missions, were built there essentially. And my father worked at NASA, and my brother Carl still works at NASA to this day. And NASA was part of the kind of economic engine of the East as it was being sort of touted as this new frontier of the city, and many other industries were compelled to set up shop in the late 50s and 60s because of NASA.
We're talking to author Sarah Broom about her new memoir, The Yellow House. We'll have more from Sarah in just a moment. Stay close.
Support also comes from Rothy's. Rothy's are the everyday flats for life on the go. Stylish, versatile, fully machine washable, and they go with everything from yoga pants to dresses and skirts. Best of all, there's zero break-in period thanks to their woven design, seamlessly crafted from recycled water bottles. Plus, Rothy's always come with free shipping and free returns and exchanges. Find out why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes at rothys.com/1A.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
J.K. Rowling wrote the final chapters of the Harry Potter series while sequestered in a hotel room. It's a strategy lots of artists and thinkers use.
They go somewhere physically isolated and different where they can, without distraction, think deeply.
Quieting the Distractions on the latest of our U2.0 series on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're speaking to Sarah Broom. Her new memoir is called The Yellow House. Let's get to some of your questions. Kevin tweeted, I grew up in New Orleans East, although my family moved prior to Katrina. I visited a couple of years after the hurricane and was excited to see the home and the oak tree my father planted still intact. Yes, emotional attachment to a place can be real, especially in Nowlands. And yes, he did spell it that way, Nowlands. Oh, Sarah, by the way, this is a bit of a sidebar, but I asked Mitch Landrieu the same question I'm going to ask you too. Is it New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, or Nowlands? What's okay and what's not okay?
I say New Orleans.
New Orleans.
I don't say, but I know I have a great friend who's also a New Orleanian. He says New Orleans. That's a thing. New Orleans is a thing, but I just say New Orleans. A Nowlands feels really performative somehow.
Joel in Central Illinois tweeted, Sarah Broom is sending me down memory lane in New Orleans East. I used to catch the bus from Carrollton to the Plaza Mall. Mm. The last house in Carrollton I lived in is a vacant lot now. Can Sarah discuss changes in culture there because the natives are gone?
Well, I think that is part of what is so crucial to thinking about the ways in which cities change. What is actually lost when people are displaced from their homes, when they aren't anymore part of a community or can't actually afford to come back? The particular street that I grew up on only has one, there are two houses left on the street, but it only has one of its original residents. And so, of course, that changes the composition of the place. And, you know, he speaks about the plaza. That was so crucial to my growing up and my sister's growing up and many of my siblings, because we all would go shopping at this big mall called the Plaza, and it's where people hung out, and it was such a kind of heart of the community. And one of the ways we understood that the neighborhood was changing was when the plaza was gone, when all of the stores closed down, when people were no longer taking the bus from Carrollton to the east. And all of that contributes to the sort of psychic value, so to speak, of a place, you know, and it really transforms what your life is like.
Sarah, what do you see as the future of areas like New Orleans East? What becomes of them? Do they just kind of remain graveyards to Hurricane Katrina? Is there work being done to bring them back to a semblance of their former glory? You know, what happens now?
Well, I think the communities are vibrant. There are people in New Orleans. New Orleans East just got a PJ's coffee shop. So that's our local one of the local coffee chains. And one only recently opened there by a New Orleans Easterner. And so that gives me so much hope that much more will happen. And I think the mayor is focusing and paying a lot of attention on New Orleans East and other communities like it. And so I feel anytime there are citizens and people in a community who love it and who are connected to it and who are willing to advocate and fight for it, there's always hope. But I think part of that is that the story, we have to be telling these stories. And the story of New Orleans can't just be that this is this wonderful city where all these great things happen. I think we have to deal honestly with what it means to be from here.
Before I let you go, would you ever move back?
Well, you know, I'm here a lot. I come about once a month or so.
I'm sorry, I mean move back to New Orleans East.
To New Orleans East. You know, I don't know if I would move back to New Orleans East, because if I lived here, I might. I might, yeah. If I lived here full time, I would. The city is still a place that I myself am coming to try to know better. So I find that exciting.
Sarah Broom, her new memoir is called The Yellow House. Sarah, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This conversation was produced by Danielle Knight and Catherine Fink here in the Twin Cities and Bianca Martin back in Washington, and it was edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. And thanks to Minnesota Public Radio for hosting us this week. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson in St. Paul. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.